flavoprotein that was defined as a protein that requires either flavin-adenine dinucleotide or flavin-mononucleotide as a non-protein helper or cofactor. So is complex 1, to practice the term, a flavoprotein? Yes, it is. Are there other flavoproteins to be found in the picture we were on a moment ago here? Yes, there are. One that you kind of knew already was a flavoprotein is succinate dehydrogenase. But before I go on to complex 2, let me finish making inside complex 1. So now we're on 5Ds. Yeah, 5D says, what's the final electron carriers that we find in complex 1s? And that would be these electron carriers indicated right here, where Fe is the chemical symbol for iron, and S is the chemical symbol for sulfur. That's a way of indicating what might be called iron-sulfur centers, or iron-sulfur clusters. And there's a picture of what one of those looks like on the very same page, page 385. Here's the irons, and no matter which one of those irons you look at, it's surrounded by sulfurs. It's like each iron has four sulfurs attached to it. Some of those sulfurs are sulfurs from the protein that's wrapped around the complex 1 protein that's wrapped around these iron sulfur centers. That's what the PR stands for the protein that's wrapped around this. And in the cases where sulfurs come from the protein, they are sulfurs of cysteine residues or building blocks, amino acids. Remember that amino acid that keeps coming up? It's come up several times now. Cysteine has always come up as an amino acid that contains sulfur. But some of the sulfurs, like the ones shown with circles around them, are not sulfurs of the protein. They are what you might call free sulfurs, unattached to anything else other than these ions. Here's cysteine mentioned in the caption. Cysteine has sulfhydryl groups versus the free sulfurs, the other sulfurs in this picture. Well, what you need to understand that we've looked at one of these iron sulfur centers is how does it function as an electron carrier? And it's the ions to focus on now. It's the ions of it that make it able to act as an electron carrier. So if ions can act as electron carriers, it must be true, I was implying earlier, that there are two forms for iron, an oxidized form that's relatively electron poor, and a reduced form that's relatively electron rich. So let's examine those two forms of iron and make sure you're familiar with them. There's no hydrogens involved in this at all. Those of you who depend on the number of hydrogens to tell you how reduced something is need to expand your ability to recognize the reduced form of something, because sometimes there's no hydrogens involved whatsoever. Okay. So here's the two forms of iron. I'm not going to tell you which is which. I'm going to ask you which is the reduced form and which is the oxidized form of iron. I'll help you out before I ask you. The reduced form is the relatively electron-rich form. That's always true. Look at the two forms of something. One's the oxidized form, one's the reduced form. It's always the reduced form that has more electrons. It's the relatively electron-rich form. Turns out that that's the form that can be a reducing agent because it has electrons to give. The reduced form. So maybe I'll ask it this way. Which of those irons has more electrons? That would be the reduced form. Fe plus 2. is the one that has more electrons. You see, it works like this, to be more exacting about it. If we use the chemical symbol F, that defines the fact that we're talking about something with 26 protons in its nucleus. The chemical symbol used is dependent on how many protons there are in the nucleus. So both of these have 26 protons. How many electrons does the Fe plus 2 ion have? Somebody quickly corrected themselves. 24 electrons. You see, protons have a plus 1 charge, electrons have a minus 1 charge, so this would add up to something with a plus 2 that charge. And now I think it's getting really easy. If you have any trouble with this at all, it's getting easy now. How many protons? How many electrons does Fe plus 3 have? It has 23 electrons. So now here's the question again. Which of these forms of iron is the relatively electron-rich reduced form? And it's Fe plus 2. You can see that now that they differ by exactly one electron. Fe plus 2 has one more electron than Fe plus 3 has. So when I talk about FMN passing electrons on to ions of iron sulfur centers, like this part of our diagram suggests, I'm talking about an FMN2H reacting with ions. You can take a couple of them, actually, since they only pick up one electron. It would involve FMN2H reacting with a couple of Fe plus 3s and a transfer of electrons that would reduce those Fe plus 3s to Fe plus 2s. And it would be those Fe plus 2s that have the electrons then. But then, the Fe plus 2s, as is being suggested by this broad gray arrow right here, the Fe plus 2s go back to being Fe plus 3s again by giving their electrons to coenzyme Qs. So if we're going to continue to follow these electrons, we'll have to next find them owned by the reduced form of coenzyme Q. So I hope that you could discuss the transitions between the two different forms of ions using redox terminology. And Fe plus 3 becomes Fe plus 2. That's reduction of Fe plus 3. And when Fe plus 2 goes back to being Fe plus 3 again, that's oxidation of Fe plus 2. And the reactions suggested here, where the electrons are first given to the ions, I would describe that as a reaction in which the ions, by gaining electrons and allowing themselves to be reduced, the Fe plus 3s are acting as oxidizing agents. So be able to use the redox terminology, even for redox reactions that don't involve hydrogens. And now we're on learning objective 5C, wanting to find the electron carriers within complex 2. Complex 2 was introduced right at the end of Tuesday's class, but you were only being reminded of it at that time, because succinate dehydrogenase was something that we described back when we were talking about the TCA cycle. When succinates are oxidized to fumarates by complex 2 or succinate dehydrogenase, the first electron carriers within complex 2 to receive those electrons are flavine and dinucleotides. Well, if flavine adenine dinucleotide is a needed cofactor here, a cofactor that lives within complex 2, which you call complex 2 a flavor protein. It's another chance that to appropriately apply that term, complex 2 is a flavor protein. And you're already understanding, I think, what happens to FADs when they accept electrons, they turn into FAD2Hs. And this diagram allows you to see that the way that they would go back to being FADs again is by giving the electrons next to some irons of some iron sulfur centers. So nobody really new to introduce. And that FAD and iron sulfur centers have already been introduced. But now I want you to notice that those are the non-protein helpers or electron carrying cofactors within complex 2. And call complex 2 a flavor protein. Is complex 2 a proton pump? This is something I mentioned on Tuesday. So we'll review. Is it a proton pump? Complex 2 is not a proton pump. It makes sense to me that it couldn't be because it doesn't cross the membrane. Well, we found a couple of things that can reduce coenzyme Q now. Those were complex 1 can reduce coenzyme Q, and complex 2 can reduce coenzyme Q. When we were summarizing what those complexes catalyze, we said that both of them reduce coenzyme Q. And before we go any further down the electron transport chain, let's find the other things that can also reduce coenzyme Q. Or, as I said at the beginning of today's lecture, the other places that electrons can enter the electron transport chain and find themselves belonging to the reduced form of coenzyme Q. And so this one here and this one here need to be introduced for us to do objective 3D. The last part of 3D says give 4 different sources of electrons that reduce coenzyme Q10. I'll tell you why it's called CoQ10 in a moment if you look at this chemical structure. But here's the 4 things mentioned in that part of objective 5D. The 4 different sources of electrons that reduce coenzyme Q10 are represented by these 4 broad gray arrows coming from 4 different places. So I guess I'm going to do that part of Objective 5D first, then I'll back up and do the first part of Objective 5D, looking at the chemical structure of coenzyme Q. I was just pointing to these doorways, so let me go ahead and tell you more about these doorways for electrons to come into the electron transport chain. This doorway right here, the one labeled glycerol 3-phosphate dehydrogenase, is an entryway for electrons that come from glycolysis. Let me remind you that there is a little bit of redox chemistry in glycolysis. It's been introduced now that glycolysis needs NAD pluses and produces NADH in the cytosol. But NADHs in the cytosol cannot act like this NADH here. This NADH here is an NADH in the mitochondrial matrix. And we've talked about where NADHs in the mitochondrial matrix can come from. I've mentioned like 3 different places that those NADHs can come from. But the NADHs made by glycolysis are in the cytosol. So they cannot do what these NADHs are doing. They cannot give their electrons to complex 1. Complex 1 only takes electrons from NADHs in the matrix. No one else will complex 1. But here's a way for the electrons from the NADHs made by glycolysis to reach the electron transport chain. And this would connect to a statement I made to the class earlier along the lines of there are aerobic ways for the NADHs made by glycolysis to become NAD pluses again so that glycolysis can't. I was showing you a diagram I'll put back up again now. And we had that discussion earlier. You guys always ask me to make it bigger at this point. So I'm trying to learn ahead of time. I in this picture, show the anaerobic way to turn NADHs made by glycolysis back into NAD pluses. And that is reducing pyruvates to lactates. The anaerobic ending is for lactate to form. But when I was showing you this picture, I said the aerobic ways to change the NADHs made by glycolysis back into NAD pluses again so that glycolysis can continue involve sending the electrons to the electron transport chain. But that only works when the cell is nicely aerobic. The electron transport chain has plenty of oxygen, in other words, and continue to accept electrons. But when that's working, when the cell is nicely aerobic, electrons from glycolysis, from these NADHs right here, can be sent to the electron transport chain. This is one of the ways that those electrons can end up entering the electron transport chain. So I'm going to go back to describing this as a doorway for electrons from glycolysis. And before we're done with the learning objectives for glycolysis, we will have talked about this doorway and one more for getting the electrons to the electron transport chain. I'm going to let it stop right there for now and pick that discussion up at a better time later. What I'd like to do now is finish describing all of these doorways whereby electrons enter the electron transport chain and reduce coenzyme Q. This doorway here is the one I still have to describe. And when I just pointed to this one and called it a doorway, and now I'm pointing to this one and calling it a doorway, maybe I should be more descriptive and say that they are proteins. And when you notice now that some non-protein helpers, both here and here, are flavin, adenine, dinucleotide, then you would call these proteins flavo proteins. So that's a flavo protein, and now we're looking at another flavo protein. And what you might be wrapping your mind around now is the fact that all four things that can reduce coenzyme Q are flavo proteins. That's probably not just a coincidence. It's probably an especially good match having flavo proteins be the ones that can reduce coenzyme Q. This doorway here, I need to describe better to finish this job. This doorway allows electrons from the FAD2Hs made by beta oxidation to reach the electron transport chain. Let me say that a couple more times because it's not very good. This is a doorway or a flavo protein that allows electrons from the FAD2Hs made by beta oxidation to reach the electron transport chain. Perhaps it's time to remind you something I told you rather recently about beta oxidation. Beta oxidation, I'll remind you all the things I've asked you to know about it so far. Beta oxidation is the pathway for using fatty acids as fuel, and it occurs in the mitochondrial matrix, and it makes these three things. From a fatty acid, it makes acetyl-CoA, NADH, and FAD2H. The NADH is made by beta oxidation, can give their, the NADHs I just said, can give their electrons to complex 1. So we've already mentioned how those electrons get into the electron transport chain. The NADHs made by beta oxidation would be in the mitochondrial matrix. So that could be where this MDH came from. Could have come from the oxidation. But now I'm getting back to the FAB2Hs, A by beta oxidation. I had not until just now told you how those electrons get to the electron transport chain and help a cell make some ATP. Those electrons reach the electron transport chain through here. This Flavo protein helps those electrons reach coenzyme Q and reduce coenzyme Q. To finish objective 5D at this point, let's look at the chemical structure of coenzyme Q. And that's at the bottom, same page. I guess the most complete drawing of its chemical structure is over here on the far right. If you want to see what these bonds go to, you have to look at the depiction on the far right to see, for example, that there's methoxy groups here and here. Look over here at this depiction where they show it all. This is the fully reduced form of coenzyme Q. And I think you can figure out now that what they're trying to do is focus your attention on where it changes when the fully oxidized form changes into the fully reduced form. It changes in this part right here. You can see that the fully reduced form has a couple more H's than the fully oxidized form has. And that's in line with some other things we've seen comparing their oxidized form to their reduced form. But I always want to remind you that get back to the fundamental definitions of oxidation and reduction, it's the number of electrons that are really concerned with. When the oxidized form of coenzyme Q becomes the reduced form of coenzyme Q, it not only gains a couple of H's, but to keep your mind full on what's most important about what it gained a couple of electrons as well. The reduced form has two more electrons rather than oxidized. Form is the relatively electron-rich form, and it has two more electrons than the oxidized form. Similar to how I discussed the structure of the cofactors derived from riboflavin, I'm going to sort of ignore what it looks like in between the fully oxidized form and the fully reduced form. I wouldn't ask you anything about the nomenclature or symbolism for the form in between these two. But I will ask you to know some terminology and symbolism for the fully oxidized form and the fully reduced form. You might symbolize the fully oxidized form with just a Q or a CoQ, and then the reduced form with a QH2. CoQH2. In this picture that we found earlier, they were using CoQ for the oxidized form and CoQH2 for the reduced form. Or you could just say Q and QH2 is what's being suggested in this next depiction of coenzyme Q. But I need you to know even more than that, I feel. Some very popular names for these two that, well, I do find them on this page in the book, but I don't find them in the caption for this diagram or in the diagram itself. Some terms that I need you to know. For the fully oxidized form, ubiquinone. Ubiquinone. And look at the chemical structure, and you might see why they're considering it to be sort of a ketone a couple of places and giving a name with an O-N-E ending, therefore, versus the reduced form of coenzyme Q, ubiquinol, with an O-L ending, indicating an alpha.
structures, I can see what they're talking about.
You get to know, it's like a ketone here and here, and at those places, you get to know all, it's like an alcohol. The ubiquity part here just refers to how these are found throughout nature, quite ubiquitous in nature. So not only humans have coenzyme Q in their cells, but coenzyme Q pretty ubiquitously in nature. And yet when we refer to coenzyme Q as coenzyme Q10, how many have heard it called CoQ10? It's a fairly popular designation for coenzyme Q. That would refer to the human form of coenzyme Q. And the 10 actually refers to this aspect of the chemical structure that you see in brackets right here. That would also be attached here in this picture and here in this picture, but you have to look at the picture on the right side to really see what's attached there. And they're suggesting a 5-carbon building block 10 times. And I jump at this opportunity to introduce that 5-carbon building block. It's such an important building block, not only in your body, but throughout nature. That 5-carbon building block that they show in brackets right there, I would just summarize it this way without any real expectations about where I might find chemical bonds and when it appears in the final structure of something that's been built using this as a building block. It might not have any double bonds in it. It might have one double bond in it. It might have two double bonds in it. I really don't have any expectations as to how it might look because I've seen it all those different ways. Here, obviously, it's got a double bond in it right there. But don't think that the term I'm going to give for this building block only fits when there's a double bond right there. I want you to more broadly apply this term to a building block that looks like this with or without double bonds in it. And its name is the isoprene building block or isoprene unit, I'll call it. I think in the caption of this diagram right here, they call them isoprenoid units. It means the same thing. I'm going to call it isoprene units. It's a very famous building block in nature. It's a building block in your body as well. Things in nature that you've heard of that are made from it would be things like beta carotene. Beta carotene is made exclusively of building blocks like that. 8 building blocks like that comprise the structure of a beta carotene molecule. But your body uses this building block to make, well, one thing we'll make a really big deal about in the second quarter is that your body uses this building block to make cholesterol. And now we're finding that your body also uses this building block to make coenzyme Q10. The isoprene building block. A lot more about it next quarter when we talk about how your body makes cholesterol. And we'll learn then how the isoprene building block is made from acetyl groups. That would be tracing it back to something you're familiar with. The isoprene building block is made from acetyl groups donated by acetyl coenzymase. And you might be figuring out, I see someone doing the math in your head, that it would take more than just one acetyl group to make a 5-carbon building block. It would take, you'd be correct if you said 3. It takes 3 acetyl groups, and 1 carbon gets lost, and you're left with a 5-carbon building block.
Did you say that coenzyme Q is common in mammals or nature?
I said coenzyme Q is common in nature. Ubiquitous in nature. I was trying to explain the ubiquity part. There's some other terminology offered in this diagram, quinone and dihydroquinol, and I'm ignoring that. I've told you the terminology I want you to be able to use. So this terminology I'm going to let go of, quinone have discovered this part of coenzyme Q's structure, let's appreciate how big that part of its structure is. They condensed it very highly. A five-carbon building block taken 10 times. My golly, that's 50 carbons. And it's all hydrocarbon here. No oxygen, there's nothing polar about the structure in that part. It's all very non-polar, hydrocarbon-like in that portion of the structure. Very unattractive to water. And would explain why coenzyme Q is such a lipid. Doesn't mix well with water. And would explain why coenzyme Q hangs out where it does. In membranes. And we're talking... we're talking a spit. Wow. Never had that happen. It is me that's doing that, isn't it? Is anybody else doing that? we're talking especially about the inner mitochondrial membrane as being a place that coenzyme Q's structure is very compatible with. Coenzyme Q's structure being such a hydrophobic structure, as we've discovered now, would make it very compatible with this very hydrophobic part of the inner mitochondrial membrane, where you see all the non-polar tails of the bilayer. That's where coenzyme Q hangs out. So that finishes learning objective 5D. And now we go on to find the non-protein help. Well, before I go on about coenzyme Q, that's a non-protein. We looked at its chemical structure. Is it a protein? Heck no, that's not a protein. So coenzyme Q might be considered a non-protein helper or cofactor here. And we've described how it functions as an electron. It goes from CoQ or ubiquinone to CoQH2 or ubiquinol by gaining two electrons. But then it goes back to being its oxidized form again by passing those electrons on to the next character in the chain. Here's our segue. The next character in the chain is complex 3. Wants a sneak preview for something that's coming up later about how the electrons from glycolysis get to here. And the key character in describing that would be a molecule called glycerol 3-phosphate, which owns electrons from the NADHs that glycolysis made and can now give them to this further protein. So be looking for that character, glycerol 3-phosphate. It holds the answer to your question. Now, thank you. Later, I'll talk about it again. I was at this point where the reduced form of coenzyme Q always gives its electrons next to complex 3. Complex 3 would be the one to get the electrons from the reduced form of coenzyme Q, no matter how the coenzyme Q got reduced. Complex 3. Gets the electrons next. And so we're at learning objective 5E at this point, the electron carriers within complex 3. And we're going to go on all the way to the end of the electron transport chain with parts B and F, the last two parts of objective 5. So here's complex 3. And the first electron carrier to gain the electrons from coenzyme Q within complex 3 is indicated here as a cytochrome. You don't really need to know, I don't feel, that it's named cytochrome B, But I do feel you need to be able to generalize about cytochromes and how they can function as electron carriers, because now we start discovering cytochromes. Starting here and going the rest of the way down the chain, we encounter cytochromes. So cytochromes, just to remind you, are proteins. They're mostly protein, but an understood non-protein helper, if we call something a cytochrome, is cytochrome's heat as a non-protein helper, by definition. So now, heme gets involved as an electron carrier, and this requires that we take a look at heme. So let's go now to figure 21.8 on page 386. And if you look right in the very middle of the structure of heme, you find the part that can actually function as an electron carrier. You find an iron in the center of the heme. Here's the iron in the center. The rest of heme has carbons in it and might be described as an organic part of heme. The rest of heme, everything else except this iron, is the porphyrin part of heme. That's the organic part of heme, the porphyrin part. And I remember introducing this terminology once before, so maybe I'll do it quickly this time. Heme is an iron porphyrin. And try and get a general picture of this in your mind. To help you with that effort, let me point out the rings like this one. Five-membered ring with a nitrogen as a ring member, and the nitrogen points right at the iron in the middle. Here's another ring like that one, and here's another ring like that one, and here's one more. There's four such rings. And those are tied together by these little one-carbon bridges, tying those four rings together. Those individual rings that have a nitrogen as a ring member, and the nitrogen's pointed right at the iron in the center, those are called pyrrole rings. They're five-membered rings with a nitrogen as a ring member. And there's four such pyrrole rings. I won't try and recreate what's already so nicely drawn right here. There's four such pyrrole rings tied together to make a bigger ring. So now I'm going to try this as a definition of a porphyrin. A porphyrin is a cyclic tetrapyrrole. That's as heavy as this terminology is going to get. A cyclic tetrapyrrole to describe four pyrrole rings tied together in a bigger ring. A cyclic tetrapyrrole to describe the porphyrin. And then what would make it be a heme would be having an iron in the middle. An iron porphyrin is a heme. The part of that that can function as an electron carrier, the part that makes it able to function as an electron carrier is the iron. So go back to thinking about irons that can go repeatedly between these two forms, Fe plus 2 and Fe plus 3. Starting off as Fe plus 3, you might imagine, but then gaining an electron to become Fe plus 2, and then giving that electron to the next character in line, and thereby returning to the Fe plus 3 point again. We've already talked about how irons can function as electron carriers, but now we're realizing that in the electron transport chain, there's two kinds of iron, you might say. There's the iron that has porphyrin wrapped around it, what I might call heme iron. And there's also the irons that we already discovered a couple of places, like right here. Also, there was one right here. Irons that are irons of iron sulfur centers. We've already talked about those. But now that I've mentioned heme iron as another kind of iron in the electron transport chain, I might go back to these ions, ions of iron sulfur centers, and classify them as non-heme ions. This is pretty standard for people to talk about heme iron versus non-heme iron. Even in nutrition classes, those terms are used, heme iron versus non-heme iron, to describe two kinds of iron that you need in food. And what's usually taught there is that the heme iron more easily absorbed by the body. So be ready to apply that terminology and hear other people use that terminology, heme iron versus non-heme iron. And you've got some pictures here if you need to look at what they look like. The non-heme iron, they refer to ions of iron sulfur centers. Heme has already come up in class a few times. For example, when we recently looked at the TCA cycle, I mentioned the TCA cycle intermediate being needed by your body to build heme, to build the porphyrin part. Some of these carbons came from, do you remember what TCA cycle intermediate I'm going to mention next? Succinyl-CoA. The succinyl groups donated by succinyl-CoAs were important to building this. But the succinyl groups don't have any nitrogens, so maybe I will try and take it a little bit further this time, really kind of rounding out your picture of what needed to build them. There's an amino acid need that would supply some of the carbons and those nitrogens. Kind of obviously, I'm thinking the nitrogens of the porphyrin did not come from succinyl-CoA. Succinyl-CoA doesn't have any nitrogens to give. Succinyl groups don't have nitrogens. But amino acids have nitrogens, you're well aware of that. And kind of logically, it took at least one amino acid to build something like this. I'm thinking quite simple-mindedly here, but it works pretty well. But if it has nitrogen in it, it took at least one amino acid to build that, one amino acid precursor. It turns out that there is only one needed here. You need more than one of these, but you only need this one amino acid, several molecules of glycine to build that porphyrin ring. You now know everything you need. You need several molecules of succinyl-CoA, and you need several molecules of glycine to build the main part of that porphyrin. Before I leave this picture, here's another opportunity to find the isoprene unit. And that part of this, what you might call a side chain hanging off of the porphyrin ring, I see an isoprene, I see three of them. Isoprene unit taken three times. We just learned that. Here it is again. I got one. Let's take a 10-minute break. precursor that leads to bilirubin. Or maybe I should have said that the other way around. The famous degradation product, when heme is degraded, is bilirubin. So that would be a possible question, maybe an extra credit question from now on, is until we study it more formally, I guess maybe be an extra credit question. For you to know that that's where bilirubin comes from. Comes from the degradation. Does it come from mommy Rubin and daddy Rubin? It comes from the degradation. One other thing I wanted to mention today is that if you would like to take advantage of the school's subsidized tutoring for biochemistry, I have just yesterday spoken with Bill Gregory in the Career Center, also known as the Tutoring Center, to make sure that this is working again this year like it did last year, and it is. There is a excellent tutor, first person I would recommend, who is willing to set up tutoring sessions with one of you or several of you at separate times. She can do this on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays after 3 o'clock. Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays after 3 o'clock. The way it works is you get 3 individual sessions with her for free, subsidized by the school, and the school pays her $12 an hour. And then if you want to continue for free, you have to get a group together. You can't just be an individual and continue for free after that. But if you get a group together, then her time continues to be free to you and the school subsidizes it. If you really want individual tutoring beyond that, then you talk to her about what she would charge you to continue doing tutoring. I'm assuming it would be $12 an hour still, but she's completely within her rights to set her own price at that point. If you're interested in that, you can get one of these forms from me or pick up one right outside the Career Center, which is room 275. These are right outside the door in the hallway, room 275. And this is the official means to get your tutoring subsidized. You have to fill out a form. I think when the first 3 sessions are free, it's assumed that those are 1-hour sessions. That's what I was, 1-hour sessions. That would certainly be enough to let you figure out if it's going to be helpful to you or not. And then get a group together. Continue to get free help. All right, back to the learning objectives for today. We're still on learning objective 5. We've gotten pretty far in the electron transport chain. And we're looking inside complex 3 at this point and talking about cytochromes because the first non-protein helpers involved in moving electrons through complex 3 are the hemes of some cytochromes. The heme ions of some cytochromes. Then I see that the electrons also belong temporarily to some irons of iron-sulfur centers. Those have already been introduced, but that S should be an uppercase S, standing for sulfur. Iron-sulfur centers have already been introduced, and here's another cytochrome. So I guess wrapping my mind around the non-protein helpers in complex 3, I see some heme ions of some cytochromes, and I also see some non-heme ions of iron-sulfur centers. Electron carriers within complex 3. This cytochrome resides within complex 3. But then the next cytochrome is not embedded in the inner mitochondrial membrane. Instead, this cytochrome can move rather freely in the intermembrane space. This cytochrome, I would say, resides in the intermembrane space. and can float along this surface of the inner mitochondrial membrane to make connections between complex 3s and complex 4s in that membrane. So notice that technically there's a difference between cytochrome C1 and cytochrome C. And I don't really feel I need you to know about cytochrome C1's name, just to know that there are some cytochromes in the complex 3. But then this cytochrome, cytochrome C, the one I just described as being rather free to move around in the intermembrane space, that one is a famous one. And I need you to know by name. Cytochrome C refers to the one that we're at now. You need to know it by name. When complex 3 lets go of electrons that have moved through it, those electrons go next to cytochrome C. So we've already summed up what complex 3 does by saying it oxidizes coenzyme Q and reduces cytochrome C, giving the electrons next to cytochrome C. And I think you already understand how cytochrome C carries electrons because you're aware that in a cytochrome there would be some heme ions, and those ions can carry electrons. And so then cytochrome C gives the electrons next to complex 4, and now we're nearing the end of the electron transport chain. But let's look at what kinds of electron carriers there are inside complex 4, left by the protein in complex 4. There are some cytochromes, cytochrome A and cytochrome A3. I don't need you to know their individual names, but let's try and get it down that there are some cytochromes in complex 4. From complex 3 to the rest of the through the rest of the end of, to the end of the chain, there are some cytochromes involved. Complex 3 has cytochromes in it, and complex 4 has cytochromes in it, and there's a cytochrome that makes the connection between complex 3 and complex 4 called the cytochrome C. All cytochromes have heme ions in them. And now I feel like there's only one more character to introduce. And it's not until complex 4 that you find copper ions involved in carrying the electrons. So in addition to the heme ions in complex 4, there are some coppers. Copper ions that act as electron carriers as well. So how does copper do that? Well, copper must have an oxidized form and a reduced form. And I hope you can figure out which is which. I need you to know that the two forms of copper are copper with a plus one charge and copper with a plus two charge. That's a little bit different than what we saw for iron. But you can still figure out which one has more electrons than the other. It's copper plus one. It has one more electron than copper plus two. And you can therefore say that copper plus one is the reduced form. Copper plus two is the oxidized form. And now my picture of coppers carrying electrons becomes they start off as copper plus twos, but then they gain an electron piece and become copper plus ones. And then they give those electrons away to somebody in the very end, allowing the coppers to go back to the plus twos. Copper plus twos. Notice who the coppers can give electrons to. When you look at who in the very end of the electron transport chain gives electrons to oxygens from O2 molecules and reduces those oxygens to oxygens of water molecules, it's the coppers that most directly, it's the coppers of complex 4 that most directly give the electrons to oxygen. We don't discover a need for copper very frequently in this class, but when we do, it seems to be kind of consistent that the copper is involved in reactions of O2. Now, don't overgeneralize from what I just said. It's certainly not going to be true by any means that every reaction that uses O2 requires copper. That's not what I meant to say. That's not what I said. But the reactions that require copper reduce seem to be pretty consistently reactions of these are too. Well, you're very ready for objective number six. This picture works really well for objective number six, 5021.5, the one we've been using so much already. Works really well for objective number six. If you start with a pair of electrons here, belonging to an NADH in the mitochondrial matrix, and those electrons can therefore go through complex one, and then to coenzyme Q, and then to complex three, and then to cytochrome C, and then to complex four, and then to oxygen. In other words, traveling the entire length of the electron transport chain, there would be four plus four plus two, that goes up 10 protons pumped from the matrix to the intermembrane space. And it takes four protons from the gradient returning to the matrix through ATP synthase to make an ATP. So do the math where 10 protons added to the gradient divided by four protons from the gradient come up with the idea of a pair of electrons from here would be worth, a pair of electrons from here would be worth 10 divided by 4, 2.5 ATPs. Best current estimates. That number has been refined over the years. If you look at older textbooks, you might find 3, but now they say 2.5. It's the best current. Versus a pair of electrons that starts here from succinate turning into fumarate. A pair of electrons that starts off belonging to succinate and then enters the electron transport chain. How many ATPs would that pair of electrons be worth? Still the same number of electrons. It's one pair of electrons or two electrons. Same number of electrons. But they enter the electron transport chain in a different place. I think I already had you thinking about this, that if you don't go through complex one, that makes a difference in how much ATP you need. Let's see, if the electrons start here and you go through complex two and then to coenzyme Q and then through complex three and then cytochrome C and then through complex four to oxygen, only six protons would be pumped from the matrix to the intermembrane space. Because complex one doesn't pump any protons unless you send electrons to it. And so how many ATPs would a pair of electrons from succinate be worth? Well, I would take six and divide by the four it takes to make an ATP. You come up with only one. That's how people come up with a tally of how many ATPs could possibly be made from some fuel molecule. Let's go on to objective 7. For objective 7, there are several parts to it, but we're thinking here about a muscle cell that goes from resting to exercising. Figure 2110 from page 391 is going to help us out quite a bit. It's on page 391. So imagine that we're looking at oxidative phosphorylation in a mitochondrion of a muscle cell. Here's the inner mitochondrial membrane in this picture. And this must be the electron transport chain with electrons going through it until they end up being given to oxygen. I would say that this would have to be complex one because it's the part shown oxidizing NADH from the mitochondrial matrix. That must be complex 1. And this one right here, this circle right here, must represent complex 4 because that's the complex that actually reduces the oxygen. And then this is just a highly schematic way that the artist suggested that some of the complexes of the electron transport chain, the proton pumps, that they add to the gradient, the proton gradient across that membrane. You guys know which complexes this part refers to. The proton pumps are complexes 1, 3, and 4. And who's this? What's its name? Yeah, that's ATP synthase. What a cool looking thing. And this is to suggest protons going through it, going back all the way to the matrix. The picture doesn't show them going that far, but going all the way back to the matrix through ATP synthase. And that being the power source that allows ATP synthase to make the distribution. Well, what part of this picture would be most immediately affected if a muscle cell, or this muscle cell, were to suddenly burst into activity because you started to exercise, run, or something, and now this muscle cell has gone from resting to exercising, and its need, I guess I'm giving away the answer, its need for ATP rises dramatically at that point. It starts through doing the contractile work, the muscle contraction. It starts using its ATP, breaking its ATP into ATP and PCL. So, which part of this picture is most immediately affected by that muscle contraction? Yeah, the relative amounts of these things would be the first thing affected in this picture. So let's start there, thinking about these would be changed by the going from resting to exercise. And then, as step by step as we can think it through, how the cell is going to increase its rate of energy production to meet the needs of the moment. So the first thing, this would be a practice in linear step-by-step thinking, I guess, as best we can delineate it. The first thing in this picture to be affected would be the rates, the amounts of these two things, where the ADP level would increase dramatically upon beginning to exercise, and the ATP level would decrease dramatically, correspondingly decrease dramatically. So, do you think that would affect the rate of this reaction? When ADP increases and ATP decreases, would you expect this reaction speed up or slow down? It would speed up. More of a reactant, less of a product. Maybe I'm thinking too much in a Chevalier's principle way here, but that's gonna make the forward reaction speed up. More of a reactant, less of a product. It'll speed up in response to that. Well, when ATP synthase speeds up this reaction right here, what does that do to the gradient that the electron transport chain has worked so hard to create? When this speeds up, does the gradient get used or does the gradient get produced?
Used.
Yeah, when this speeds up, that's going to use the gradient. That's used for the gradient. The gradient will decrease. The potential energy stored in that gradient will be decreased by using the gradient. And the next thing to think about would be, how would that decrease in the gradient now affect the rate of the electron transport chain? Yeah, you can think of the electron transport chain as trying to maintain that gradient. And when the gradient begins to decrease, the electron transport chain would speed up in response next. Your textbook talks about the electron transport chain trying to push against the gradient, and as the gradient is used by ATP synthase, it becomes easier to push against the gradient, and the electron transport chain would speed up. And so what would happen next to the rate of using oxygen? If the electron transport chain speeds up, the rate of using oxygen would speed up. What about the relative amounts of these two things? Once the electron transport chain speeds up in response to everything else we've described to here, once the electron transport chain speeds up, what does that do to the relative amounts of NADH and NAD plus in the mitochondrial matrix? Would the amount of NADH increase or decrease? The amount of NADH would decrease. The amount of NAD plus would increase. And be ready to describe this in terms of ratios of one of those to the other as well. The ratio of NADH to NAD plus would be decreased, but the reciprocal, people choose to express the reciprocal ratio, the ratio of NAD plus to NADH would increase. That would be described either way. It happens to the ratio of one to the other, regardless of which one is expressed on top. That expression of the ratio. So in objective 7, we're now at 7 deep. We've done 7 A, B, and C. We're at 7 deep. It says predict the effect of, you could say sort of the same thing in all these different ways, a decrease in the mitochondrial NADH, or an increase in the mitochondrial NAD+. Or you might speak of an increase in the NAD plus to NADH ratio. Or you might speak of, this would be sort of saying the same thing still, a decrease in the NADH to NAD plus ratio. How would that, said all those different ways, affect the rate of the TCA cycle? We not too long ago talked about the TCA cycle and some things that would control its rate. And the NADH to NAD plus ratio was one of those things. What would happen to the rate of the TCA cycle when NADH decreases and NAD plus increases? The TCA cycle would speed up in response. This is working out well. I feel confident that we're thinking this through correctly because that's exactly what I would want to happen. I would want, when this cell goes from resting to exercising, I would want it to speed up its TCA cycle. I would want all this aerobic business, aerobic use of fuels, to speed up as much as would be allowed by the amount of oxygen present. I would want it to speed up as much as possible. And there are some other things in the mitochondrial matrix besides the TCA cycle that would also be affected by the change in the amounts of these things. When the electron transport chain speeds up and the ratio of NADH to NAD plus changes, that influences not only the rate of the TCA cycle, but also the rate of the pyruvate dehydrogenase reaction, and also the rate of beta oxidation. Did I mention all of those when you can connect with my learning objective? Yes, that's what 7D is all about. Not only the TCA cycle, but the pyruvate dehydrogenase reaction and beta oxidation. All of those things are inhibited by NADH and or stimulated by NAD+. So same conclusion for the pyruvate dehydrogenase reaction and beta oxidation as what you told me just a moment ago for the TCA cycle. All this aerobic use of fuel is speed up. And we as step-by-step as possible, starting with how muscle contraction would affect the amounts of these things we have discussed now, how all the aerobic pathways for using fuel in this mitochondria can speed up. Well, to practice some of these thoughts again, but going the other direction, there is learning objective number 8. Something that would force everything to slow down would be if the cell runs out of oxygen. Something that would force all the aerobic business to slow down would be if the cell runs out of oxygen. Then hopefully anaerobic business will speed up because the aerobic business is going to have to slow down. The cell runs out of oxygen. So learning objective 8 says if a muscle cell becomes deprived of oxygen, this might be just because you're exercising that muscle so vigorously that your body isn't trained well enough to supply it with oxygen fast enough. You might be deprived of oxygen for that reason. You're just working too hard. Or it might be something more pathological, like a blood clot or something. If a muscle cell becomes deprived of oxygen, explain as step-by-step as possible how, meaning the mechanism by which all these things would slow down. Oxidative phosphorylation, the TCA cycle, pyruvate dehydrogenase reaction, and beta oxidation. All those things that we explained as speeding up in learning objective 7, now we're going to sort of approach them other direction and explain them slowing down. And then objective 8 when the cell runs out of oxygen. So I think I want to still use the same instead of using this picture still I'm going to go back to the very first picture in chapter 21, to the 21.1 where we're shown oxidative phosphorylation. If you run out of oxygen, the first part of this picture to be affected would be this. You have less of this, less oxygen. Well, that means that complex 4 wouldn't have anybody to give electrons to. And complex 4 would fill up with electrons and it would stop taking electrons. That's sort of the way my thoughts would begin here. And it would proceed in this way where everything backs up with electrons that can't get rid of. Just keep going along those lines. I said if the cell doesn't have any oxygen, complex 4 wouldn't have anybody to give its electrons to, so it would end up with electrons it can't get rid of, and it would stop taking any more electrons. That means that cytochrome C's wouldn't have anybody to give their electrons to. Complex 4 is not taking electrons anymore. Complex C's would fill up with all the complex C's would be in their reduced states, unable to give away their electrons. And so complex C's would stop taking electrons, which means that complex cytochrome C's would stop taking electrons, which means that complex 3's wouldn't have anybody to give their electrons to. It backs up with electrons where it's all full with electrons and can't give any. And won't take any more. So coenzyme Q's unable to give their electrons to complex 3's because complex 3's is not taking electrons. Coenzyme Q's all end up in their reduced forms with nobody that they can give their electrons away to. And so there wouldn't be any coenzyme Q's taking electrons anymore. They're all filled up already. And you see how it would back up all the way to complex 1s would stop taking electrons from NADHs because the complex 1s are already filled with electrons and can't take any more. Now we're getting to the ratio of NADH to NAD plus would change. Step by step as I could do it for you just now, we've gotten to this would lead to a tremendous increase in the ratio of NADH to NAD plus in the mitochondrial matrix. And that's going to cause an increase in the NADH to NAD plus ratio in the mitochondrial matrix is going to cause the TCA cycle to slow down. It's going to cause the pyruvate dehydrogenase reaction to slow down. And I'm asking you to take my word for it, that will also cause beta oxidation disorder. All this aerobic use of fuel would be sort of forced to slow down. It wants to go faster, but there's not enough oxygen. Well, something that makes it not quite so bad is that the anaerobic use of fuel would correspondingly speed up. Oh, I meant to ask you to predict that. The learning objective 8 says, predict what would happen to the rate of glycolysis in this cell. And we haven't talked enough in detail about glycolysis yet for you to see how it would happen. Eventually, I'll fill in that gap and tell you how it happens. But I'm thinking that you might predict at this point that glycolysis should speed up, because that's an anaerobic way for the cell to make some ATP, and boy, does that cell need ATP. That's a way to make some ATP that does not require oxygen. And thank goodness it does speed up. But it's going to be glycolysis in a cell that doesn't have a working electron transport chain right now, because there's not enough oxygen for the electron transport chain. And so once glycolysis changes the glucose to pyruvate, what's going to be the fate of the pyruvate next? What's the anaerobic way for this to end? Yeah, the pyruvate is going to be reduced to lactate. This figure is on page 406. It's from the chapter on glycolysis. Page 406. And similar to what I've been saying a few times now with the aid of this drawing, glycolysis needs NAD pluses and makes NADHs. We'll see exactly where in glycolysis that happens eventually. You're already appreciating from things that have been done in class that glycolysis needs NAD pluses and produces NADHs. The aerobic way to turn NADHs back into NAD pluses again so that glycolysis can continue would be to send electrons to the electron transport chain. Maybe I didn't say aerobic ways, because there's a couple of ways to send electrons to the electron transport chain. But we're just talking about, in objective number 8, a cell where the electron transport chain is not working. The cell has run out of oxygen. The electron transport chain is filled with electrons that it can't get rid of and isn't taking electrons anymore. So this would be the only way. In a cell that's anaerobic, this would be the only way to turn NADHs made by glycolysis back into NAD pluses again so that glycolysis can continue. You can see that in this diagram they've connected things in a way very similar to what I was doing for you here. The NADHs from glycolysis can be turned back into NAD pluses again, but that requires reducing pyruvate to lactate. Here's their chemical structures I've already asked you to be able to draw up on Route 8, I believe. Maybe I'm asking you to draw it again here. No, this time I asked you to draw the structure of black tape to sort of complete your ability to draw both of these. Learning Objective 8 asks you to be able to draw black tape. I hope that after you've looked at my Route 8 black tape side by side a couple of times, that you'll always think of my Route 8 as the ketone form and black tape as the alcohol form. And that would allow you, I think, to keep straight their relationship to each other, what kind of a reaction changes one into the other. And I'm asking you to really master this reaction catalyzed by lactate dehydrogenase. It's a reversible reaction. In this discussion, we were talking about going from pyruvate to lactate, going that direction. And I hope that going that direction from pyruvate to lactate, you would say, would use NADH and make NAD plus. That is really the reason for this reaction, going from pyruvate to lactate, I would say. It's not that the cell wants lactate, it's that the cell wants NAD plus, so that glycolysis. For objectives 9 and 10, we consider something called uncoupling. And this is the picture that I'll be using for those learning objectives. Figure 2112, which is on page 393. With the two previous learning objectives, we saw how the synthesis of ATP and the electron transport chain are pretty tightly coupled, it might be said, under ordinary conditions. Where, like in objective number 7, we saw that when the ATP synthase speeds up, the electron transport chain speeds up in response to that. And then in objective 8, we see both ATP synthase's ability to do its job and the electron transport chain's ability to do its job coming to a halt because of a lack of oxygen. So with those previous learning objectives, we sort of saw how under ordinary conditions, the two parts of oxidative phosphorylation, the electron transport chain being the first part and ATP synthase being the second part, the two parts of oxidative phosphorylation generally speed up together or slow down together. We thought it through as step by step as possible how that would happen. And what keeps them so tightly connected to each other, or coupled, you might say, is the proton gradient that the electron transport chain produces in ATP synthase uses. Uncoupling would occur if the gradient produced by the electron transport chain is used for something other than making ATP. What I'm describing is ways for the protons to re-enter the matrix where they don't go through ATP synthesis. For example, protons re-entering the matrix through a doorway like this one. This membrane is the inner mitochondrial membrane of a cell, of a cell's mitochondria. The inner mitochondrial membrane. This is the outer. No, it's not the outer mitochondrial membrane. That's the outer membrane of the cell. Here's the inner mitochondrial membrane. We found it. Here's the electron transport chain producing the proton gradient across that membrane. And for that gradient that's being produced by the electron transport chain to be used to make ATP, the protons have to re-enter the matrix through ATP synthesis. And here they are, re-entering the matrix through another doorway instead, a doorway other than ATP synthase. And when the protons come in to the matrix, back into the matrix through this doorway, no ATP gets made. This would seem to upset the connection between the electron transport chain and ATP synthase, allowing protons back into the matrix through doorways other than ATP synthases. That's interfering with the connection or the tightly coupled connection, the coupling between the electron transport chain and ATP synthase. I'm trying to explain how the term uncoupled is used. Well, think about the electron transport chain. Here it's called the respiratory chain. That's another name for the electron transport chain. Think about the electron transport chain. It's trying to maintain that gradient. If the protons are coming back into the matrix, that's going to keep decreasing the gradient that the electron transport chain tries to maintain. And in an earlier learning objective, objective 7, we said that the electron transport chain would speed up. When the gradient is decreased, the electron transport chain speeds up. It's as if your textbook says the electron transport chain pushes against a proton back pressure or pushes against the gradient. It would be a simpler way to say that. And when the gradient decreases, the electron transport chain speeds up. It's allowed to speed up. But we're not making ATP. We're using lots of oxygen. When the electron transport chain speeds up, the use of oxygen speeds up. You'd have to burn more fuel to send electrons to the electron transport chain when the electron transport chain speeds up. Fuel use, oxygen consumption, those things would speed up. But then the protons just come right back into the matrix through a doorway like this one. And instead of making ATP so much, you make a lot of heat instead. The electron transport chain, bless its heart, working as hard as it can, produces a lot of heat. Well, this doorway that I keep pointing to would be referred to as an uncoupling protein. Protein in the inner mitochondrial membrane that allows protons to go from the intermembrane space back into the matrix. An uncoupling protein. When protons go through it, no ATP gets made. Well, the cell that they show here is labeled a brown fat cell. Brown adipose tissue, brown fat, a brown fat cell, which is different than a white fat cell or a typical adipocyte, in that a brown fat cell has more mitochondria. That's really what lends it its brown appearance, is brown fat cells have a lot more mitochondria. And brown fat cells are specialized, rather than have storing fat the way white fat cells are, brown fat cells are specialized in producing. Not so much for storage of fuel as they are. The first uncoupling protein to ever be discovered was the one that's in brown fat cells, the one that's in this picture. It's sometimes called thermogenic because of its participation in the production of heat. But it's also okay to call it uncoupling protein 1. And I want you to realize that it's not the only uncoupling protein. It's just the first one that was discovered. And your textbook does a pretty good job on page 392. Of telling you about some other uncoupling proteins that have more recently been discovered. For example, uncoupling protein 2, which is in most cells, not just brown fat cells, but in most cells. And uncoupling protein 3, which is found mostly in skeletal muscle cells. Well, let's imagine that my body has more uncoupling protein 2 and uncoupling protein 3 in your body. Or maybe we've got the same amounts of those, but my versions of those are more active than yours for genetic reasons. How might that influence our tendencies towards obesity? This is all I have time to say today. Pretty much what I've said up here. If I have more uncoupling proteins than you, or mine are especially active, then I would have to burn more fuel every day just to make the same amount of ATP as you. I would have to burn more fuel just to make the same amount of ATP. You see how I'm in essence saying that my basal metabolic rate would be higher than yours, and that my tendency towards obesity would be lower than yours. I haven't had this idea tested, but I think there might be something to what I just suggested about long times of thinking. Okay. That's all we have time for today. Good luck on your hand.
Why'd you call me a hippo?